are there before finally doing something with TFTs? Are there questions for last week? If not, we are done with the background section. Section two, which is about just studying some basic properties. So we ended up with giving a definition of what a topological field theory is last time. And this now we will like just explore some consequences of this definition and then also see what they are, what they relate to in dimension one. Okay. And for concreteness, we will at least partially restrict to theories taking values in vector spaces. So we start with a theory and recall from last time it's a functor from this Bordism category to vector spaces, but then it's also a natural transformation epsilon, which goes from Z on the unit, which is the empty set, to the unit in vector spaces. Let's work over C to this unit. And then in addition, there's something encoding how this is monoidal, meaning that if I evaluate my field theory on the disjoint union of two manifolds, I get an isomorphism, which is this mu and sigma sigma prime to the tensor product of the two things. So far, this is somehow the type of structure we have. And then well, the first thing we can do is we can now pick some closed manifold. This is a map in the is a morphism in the Bordism category from the empty set to the empty set. This is a diffeomorphism class of closed n-dimensional manifolds. And what I can do is I can evaluate my field theory on it. So I get a map from Z of the empty set to Z of the empty set. And then I can compose here with this isomorphism epsilon. This is epsilon. Well, actually, it's epsilon inverse of our conventions. So this goes to C. And I can compose here with epsilon. So I get a map from C to C. And I can identify this with a complex number. So we define an invariant depending on the theory for M, which is defined to be just this composition. And then I evaluate it at 1. So I take this map, which goes from C to C. I plug in the number 1, and I get some complex number. And by construction, this is an invariant of M under diffeomorphism, because already the thing I plug in was a diffeomorphism class of manifolds. Okay.
What is it that we built here?
We start with a field theory, right? And then for every closed n-dimensional manifold, it will come with the information of an invariant of this manifold, so the partition function.
Okay.
Essentially. So this is right. Remember that this definition tries to give an axiomatization of what type of properties partition functions satisfy under cutting and gluing, more or less. So there's this partition function. And now we just want to see what things we can say about this starting from the definition, from this formal properties, which we motivated from path integrals in the beginning. And the first thing we can say is the following proposition, which is 2.1, which says that if I look at the invariant for the disjoint union of two manifolds, then it's a product. So it's the invariant will always be multiplicative under disjoint union. And we will give a proof of this. So first using the graphical calculus for symmetric monoidal functors. If I draw Z as this bubble, then this was epsilon. This was epsilon, this is epsilon inverse. And I have two maps in my Bordism category, M and N, which go from the unit, which we don't draw, to the unit, so it's something like this. And I can manipulate this. This is also the same as wrong way around. So I start with the disjoint union, which is the tensor product. So I take the tensor product of these two things and put them in a bubble, which is the functor Z. Then I can move them around just using the graphical calculus in the Bordism category. And then here I have Z with nothing inside, so I can split this out as a bubble. This is NM. And then I move this to just get the product. Okay. So this is what one can show a statement like this using the graphical calculus we introduced last time, but there we will also just write it out as an equation. So this, because I think this might be looks a bit sketchy, maybe if you see it for the first time. So as an equation, it's epsilon applied to 1 applied to Z of the disjoint union of M and N composed with epsilon inverse. So if I take the disjoint union of M and N, this is the same as composing M and N as automorphisms of the empty set. This is like this first step here. So we find this is Z of M composed with N, epsilon of 1. Okay, then the next thing I use that Z is a functor, meaning I can write this as Z of M, Z of N. This becomes equal to epsilon minus 1, Z of M composed with Z of N, epsilon of 1. Okay, now the last step is just I plug in epsilon times epsilon inverse here. So we have epsilon minus 1, Z of M, epsilon, epsilon inverse, Z of N, epsilon on 1. And you see this is the invariant for N, this is the invariant for M. So we get that this is the product.
Can you say again, why the disjoint union of M with N is equal to the composition of M with N?
I mean, I have M was some Bordism from the empty set to the empty set.
Yeah.
Right? And then I compose it with some other thing, which I call N. Right?
Yeah.
And this composition is the same as taking the disjoint union of the two manifolds.
Okay, it feels almost in a trivial sense in some way, but is all true because it's from the empty set to the empty set? Or?
Yes. I mean, in general, and what will be true in or what's true in any monoidal category is if you have something, so you have a map from the unit to the unit, and you tensor this with another map from the unit to the unit, then I can somehow move this down and write it as this thing composed with the identity, move this down by up and move it as something composed with the identity. And then this will be the same as this type of composition. And this way you also see that the endomorphism of the unit actually always will be commutative, because I can put them together this way or that way. This is sometimes called an Ekman-Hilton argument. But you see here I have these two boxes and I can move them like this or the other way around. So this will imply that it's commutative. And it's called Ekman-Hilton because it's the same reason why higher homotopy groups are commutative. Yeah. Okay. So the next thing, I think I will just say in words briefly and not do in that great of a detail. But if I have an object sigma in the Bordism category, this is some n minus one dimensional manifold, I can define what's called the mapping class group of sigma. This is like, this is a group, we take all of the orientation preserving diffeomorphisms of sigma, and then we take the connected component of this group. And the statement is just that so if I have a diffeomorphism phi, what I can do is I can actually build a morphism in the Bordism category from this, which as a Bordism is just sigma times an interval. But then I also need to give you these embeddings here and here. And what I do is I just here I apply phi times the identity, and here I apply the identity. So this gives me, for every diffeomorphism, I get a morphism in the Bordism category. So I can evaluate this. And I think we call this thing phi. And then I can evaluate my COE Z on this thing, which is sometimes called a mapping cylinder. This is a map from Z of sigma to Z of sigma. And I mean, yeah, I guess this is going to be an exercise. It is just like that this construction gives an action of the mapping class group of sigma on V of sigma. Okay, so if you have a field theory, you always get actions of these groups. And the famous example is if you put in a two torus here, this would be SL2Z. And if you don't want to do the exercise, if I send my notes around, there are a lot of details on that in there, but I just decided to skip it because it's not so insightful to do it.
M of E is a morphism between what?
Right, this is a Bordism from, it's a morphism from sigma to sigma. Yeah, which is built by taking the cylinder but twisting the identification here via the diffeomorphism. And then I can evaluate Z on it, which gives me a representation on this vector space.
Why did you write it in like this correspondence way with like extra identity on the right?
Well, here?
No, like this thing. I mean, why do you need like this? The other term was identity going from sigma.
As identity times some right here we had some rescaling. I just need to give you a Bordism, right? So I should give you a manifold, and I should give you an embedding, like something here and something here. So.
Oh yeah, right.
So and I just say this uses a twist, and this just doesn't do anything. You should also convince yourself that if I do this as a morphism, it's actually the same as if I would have done the inverse on the other side. Right there, we had this notion of Bordisms, of diffeomorphisms relative boundary. But I just need to give these, like this is somehow what I need to tell you if I want to specify something. And here I should also, right there should be this, like 1 over 8, just to somehow make this interval small enough to sit somewhere here. That they don't touch. Okay. Yeah.
Sorry, so good. You're good.
No. Just for clarifying. okay. So this spaces of diffeomorphisms and sigma, the connected component of that, we want to, through a diffeomorphism, wait, what induced an action on it? Oh my god.
So I claim, if you have a diffeomorphism, you can do this construction of this mapping cylinder, which gives you a morphism in the Bordism category from sigma to sigma, which depends on the diffeomorphism.
Okay.
And then I can evaluate the field theory on this to get a linear map from here to here. And now I claim that the exercise is to convince yourself that this gives you a representation of the mapping class group. So there are two things. First, you should see that if I pick a different diffeomorphism, which is in the same path-connected component, then I get the same linear map. And you need to show that these things compose correctly, meaning that if I compose two mapping cylinders, it's like the mapping cylinder for the composition.
And the fact that this you mentioned something about the lib and the connected component. I mean, that's related to the pi zero you wrote.
Yes.
There's something I'm failing to grasp, but maybe other people have more questions to, I don't know.
Yeah, so you're abelianizing the diffeo?
It's not abelian. I just take pi zero. Like, I just take I take connected components.
I see.
Yeah, I just identify two diffeomorphisms which are related by an isotopy.
Okay, then this, I don't understand what M of phi is. So M of phi still lives in Bord N?
Yeah, M of phi is, it's a morphism from sigma to sigma, which is in Bord N.
And so your diagram on the middle of the board, what exactly is that saying? I don't think I'm following.
This diagram.
Yeah.
So a morphism in the Bordism category is a cobordism. And a cobordism consists of a manifold, which is sigma times 0, 1, plus some identification of a neighborhood of the boundary with this type of manifold. Sigma times this. And, oh, this is the wrong thing. So identifications of these things with some neighborhood of the boundary in there. And then it's equivalence class of these things up to diffeomorphism. So I give diffeomorphism's relative boundary. So I give you a representative for a morphism in the Bordism category.
Okay. Yeah. And when you write pi zero, yeah, you mean, so it's not only the connect, you meant, I understood for a second it was the connected component to the identity, or rather is the group that made of the different connected components.
Yes.
Okay.
It's the group made out of the different connected components.
So the action is just, you just attach cylinders on and on.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Thank you.
And now we will leave this behind. This is not part of the course. So the next thing we will introduce is a construction, which is known as dimensional reduction. So it allows you to take higher dimensional field theories and build lower dimensional theories out of them. Maybe. Sometimes this is also called compactification. So there's a definition. So we fix some data. So let Z from Bord N to vect be a TQ of T. And we fix some manifold omega. So omega is an oriented closed k less than n dimensional. Manifold. So I somehow want to take this theory Z I have here and compactify it on this manifold sigma to get a new theory, which is now of dimension n minus k. And then, so this is what we will do. The dimensional reduction, which we call the reduction of Z along omega, and write it like this, is the theory. So I need to give you a symmetric monoidal functor from now a Bordism category of lower dimensions that will turn out to be n minus k. I need to give you a functor from here to vector spaces. And I do this by first constructing a functor to the n-dimensional Bordism category and then evaluating Z on it. And this functor is just taking the taking the product with omega. So what it does is I have some cobordism here from sigma to sigma prime. And this gets mapped to m cross omega, which is now a Bordism from sigma cross omega to sigma prime cross omega. Okay, so what the dimensional reduction does, it somehow evaluates this larger theory on things which look like something n minus k dimensional times omega, which is a theory of lower dimensions.
Actually, I have two questions.
Okay.
It's often in field theory that the modular group or the mapping class group action on omega gives you some electromagnetic duality in the lower dimensions. Does that happen in TPFT as well?
I mean, what happens is, right, diffeomorphisms of omega will act via natural transformations here.
Oh.
Right? So the mapping class group will act on this, so it will act on the dimensional reduction. And then this might give you some dualities or not. Yeah. But you will definitely, this theory will automatically have a symmetry coming from the mapping class group of omega.
I see. And the second question is, can we consider the twisted compactification? For example, we turn on some blocks or Wilson loops in omega. And
yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you can, you need to, right? I mean, generally, right, I said this is times omega.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to allow twisted things, what you need to do is you need to modify what this Bordism category is, right?
Okay.
So somehow if I would have a, right? I mean, what you want is somehow this doesn't look like a product, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want like some bundle of omegas over whatever your base is. So you might say, take here a Bordism category where the objects are n minus k dimensional manifolds equipped with a fiber bundle with fiber omega. And then the same construction you can do, and then you would see all the twisted things. There's somehow, topologically, there's always a universal thing you could do here which encodes all the possibilities. But for us, this is just, we will just use this simple thing. And I mean, one reason for why this is useful is that this allows us to study one-dimensional theories but learn a lot about theories in any dimension. So let me just say this, that in particular, for all sigma in Bord n, right, these are closed, compact, n minus one-dimensional manifolds. There's a 1D PQFT. The reduction along sigma of Z, and it maps, which maps a point with a positive orientation to Z of sigma. So one thing this tells us is that whatever the state space of my theory on a manifold, on a codimension one manifold, is it's part of the one-dimensional TQFT. So anything we learn about a one-dimensional TQFT will also apply to the vector space of a TQFT in any dimension. And we will use this to show certain consequences of the definition. The first one is that these vector spaces will always be finite dimensional. Like somehow based on the definition, it's impossible to write something down where this is infinite dimensional. And the other consequence we will see is that if you have a natural transformation between TQFTs, it will automatically be invertible. It's not possible to write down non-invertible maps. In particular, it makes it easy to check whether two things are naturally isomorphic. Because as soon as you can write down a natural map, it will automatically be an isomorphism. Okay. So this is the motivation why we want to understand 1D. So that's the goal. And for this, we quote a lemma, which you might also call in the context of this effect, which is that if I have every connected compact 1D manifold is diffeomorphic. Either S1 or an interval compact connected oriented, meaning that if I look at connected oriented manifolds which are compact, they all look either like an interval with boundaries or a circle, and these are all they are. So this is somehow what we will use to get an understanding of the one-dimensional Bordism category, and then as a consequence also of one-dimensional field theories. Yep.
What happens to the orientation under the diffeomorphism?
It's preserved. Okay. It's orientationally preserving. When I say diffeomorphism, I always mean orientation preserving diffeom.
But this is not a consequence of this, right? Because it's the word lemma makes me think of. Oh, or is it? Can you prove this because of this?
No.
Okay.
It's just something we use to study one-dimensional theories. That's also why it's a fact.
Yeah, exactly. I imagine the word fact was also because of that too.
It's something which is true, which we will not prove.
Okay.
Essentially, I don't know. Like the only proof I know is using Morse theory, and I don't want to go into Morse theory. And there might be, this also seems, right, intuitively this seems easy, right?
Intuitively true, yeah.
There's like an interval and a circle, and what else can you do in 1D? So we will use this as just the following kind of obvious fact, is if I have a cobordism, every 1D, or I mean, this is true more generally, is a disjoint union of its connected components. So if you have a Bordism right, if we have a Bordism, maybe something from 3 points to 1 point, right, this is a Bordism from plus, plus, minus to plus. Then I can write it as a disjoint union of this Bordism with that vortism and this one. And why is this useful? Because if we have a topological quantum field theory, we know that disjoint unions will be mapped to tensor products. So to tell you what's happening here, I just need to tell you what happens on the individual pieces, and then what the disjoint union of those is. Okay. And furthermore, I can, if I have a circle, I can always write it as a composition of two of these things in the Bordism category. So the conclusion is that the only information we need to specify is what our field theory does on the following six bordisms. So just the identity from plus to plus, the identity from minus to minus. So these are just the orientations of these things. Okay, this is actually maybe oriented like this. Then I have this elbow thing which goes from plus to minus. I also have the thing which goes in the other direction from plus to minus. And then I have these two things, which is plus minus, minus plus. So if I know what my field theory does on these six bordisms, I claim that from this you can build all the other bordisms by either taking disjoint union or composition. Okay, and then let me note, we already know what it does on these things because they are the identity, so it will map them to the identity. These two things, they're actually related by the braiding. So they are related by sigma, as well as these two things are related by sigma. And since our field theory is required to be symmetric monoidal, that means that this one is just this one composed with the flip vector spaces. So we also know what's happening there. So actually, the theory is completely determined by giving the following information. So I need to give z on a positive point, which I will call v plus, z on a negative point, which we will call v minus, and then two maps, z of this thing, which goes from v plus tensor v minus to c, and then z of, which one did I pick? This thing, which is a map from c to v minus. How do I read them? Ah, this from here to here. So v minus tensor v plus. And I claim this information is enough to determine the full field theory just by using tensor products and composition. However, I cannot pick whatever I want because these things will need to satisfy some relations coming encoded by the topology of these type of things. But let me just give you as an example the value of the theory on this bordism if after I have specified this information.
Sorry, Lucas. The arrow is an orientation on the bordism, but you change the line at some point. Does that matter, the arrow?
This is the orientation of the line somehow, after one, and this now should go from the negatively oriented point to the negatively oriented point. So, yeah.
It matters in which direction it goes.
It's just the line has somehow two orientations, from here to here and from here to here. And one is a bordism, is the identity bordism from plus to plus. The other one is the identity bordism from minus to minus.
Okay, I'm having troubles with the compatibility with the orientations, how the arrow must go with the minus and pluses, or if it matters.
The arrow needs to point into a minus and out of a plus at the source, and the opposite at the target side, if that helps.
Okay. And, I also have a question about whether this claim does not apply to higher dimensional cobordisms.
Which claim?
The claim about, is it if the,
No, this is that it's all, I mean, every cobordism is a disjoint union of its connected components. That always applies.
Okay.
But in 1D, I claim the connected components are easy because they're either this or that, right? So I either have a circle, the circle I can build out of two of those, or I have an interval. And then the interval I can have in six different ways. It could be an identity from plus to plus, an identity from minus to minus, a morphism from plus tensor minus to nothing, or the other way, or it could be a morphism from nothing to plus tensor minus. Right? So I just somehow list all the possible building blocks. And I ignore the circle because I can build the circle out of these things. And in higher dimensions, you might try to do the same. But then you notice that there are, somehow you cannot just list all connected components. Actually, next week, we will do the same in 2D, where we will list like all surfaces and then show that you can, and essentially you know that all the surfaces you can build by gluing together a pair of pants and some discs which look like this or that. So we will use this type of decomposition next week to give a classification of 2D.
Okay.
But for today, we will stick with
it. Is Wilson's and Lyot's related by time reversal transformation? Is that the interpretation? They are two reverse spaces.
Yeah.
So they are related by just a reflection.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, this, right, it's an oriented theory, so it doesn't have a time reversal symmetry, but yes. Exactly. You have, right, the Bordism category has an automorphism which reverses the direction of time, and this would exchange V plus and V minus. Yeah.
So what does the Z of a single point mean? Is it?
The point is an object in the one-dimensional Bordism category, right? Because the objects are zero-dimensional manifolds with an orientation.
Ah, I see.
And so it just means evaluate the field theory at this object.
So look, it's a still more basic question. So how do you more precisely put orientation in a single point?
Okay. I mean, yeah, I skipped the explanation of what orientations are last week. So there are some different things. The one way is, you might, instead of thinking of an orientation of this, you think of an orientation of some small neighborhood, right? This is really what somehow we needed to look at this, and it was important that this has somehow an orientation. It has two orientations corresponding to the two orientations of a point. Otherwise, an orientation of a manifold, what it always is at every point you have a tangent space. And this has a set of ordered bases, and you need to assign consistently signs to these. But if you're in 0D, so a point, like the tangent space is just 0. So 0 only has one ordered basis, which is 0. And now you need to say this is either plus or minus. So this is, you will assign to a point. But the way effectively you should think of it is really assigning an orientation to something which looks like this, right? So it means somehow things go out of plus and into minus. So let me just reiterate. In the Bordism settings, we always, right, the Bordisms, they always come with these colors. And now if I take the positively oriented point, this is just 0, 1, with the orientation which goes from 0 to 1. If I would do this, then it's still 0, 1, but now the orientation goes in the other direction.
Yes. Another question, so why is the Bordism from, let's say, plus to plus identity necessarily? I couldn't have more morphisms?
You can have, right? There are more morphisms from plus to plus, but this one, which is just plus times an interval, this is by definition the identity. But another morphism would be this one, which is not the identity. It is also a morphism from plus to plus.
But why the plus to plus would have to be the identity?
Yeah.
What?
Like why this Bordism specifically has to be identity?
You mean why this thing is the identity? I mean, it's just what the identity in the Bordism category always is.
Okay, I see.
The identity at sigma is just sigma times this thing seen as a Bordism. This will always be the identity.
Okay.
Because if I have a Bordism and I glue in this interval, this cylinder here, right? The thing I get after gluing, it's diffeomorphic to the original manifold.
Nice.
More questions?
Naively, also, what's the problem with putting plus plus? It must be very silly, but on the same side?
What do you mean? You cannot.
I cannot join them with a line, oriented line.
You do this, right?
Yeah.
So this needs to be oriented.
Yeah, and I cannot join.
But then locally, right, you know it needs here, it needs to look like this, and here it also needs to look like
this. Yeah, it's not compatible.
And then, right, there's no way of making them meet, which is oriented. Right, if you draw this, this is not a consistent orientation.
Yeah. Would there be some type of physical argument? Because I mean, you can certainly replace your Bordism category by a symmetric monoidal category where you can have self-dual objects and still consider that.
Yeah, I mean, you can do.
I don't know if there's a meaning attached to that.
You can. There's a thing where you do unoriented Bordisms, which means you forget the orientation. First of all, plus and minus become the same, but you can have this thing. So it exactly becomes self-dual. Like physically, this would be a theory with a time reversed symmetry, or something where you have a time reversed symmetry and you gauge it. So you cut like a background field for a time reversed symmetry breaks. It's like an unoriented manifold. So yes, this works. Okay, what was I going to do? Explain you how to write this Bordism just using these building blocks. So first of all, we have an input, which is V plus. So the input is V plus, tensor V plus, tensor V minus, because that's what I get if I evaluate the field theory on this object, because I know it's on plus, it's V plus, and then this is a disjoint union, so I know it's the tensor product. And then the first thing I do is just I do the identity on V plus, so nothing is happening here, and I do this evaluation here. So I do tensor Z on this. Then I only have a copy of V plus left. So in the diagram, I'm now at this point. Now I need to write the circle only using these two things. So what I do is I first take the circle. I actually decided to draw this with the other orientation. Don't want to get confused. So this is as a manifold. It's the same as this thing. And now I can evaluate on both of these pieces. And there's a flip in here. So I first do nothing on V plus and Z on this. Then I'm at V plus. Yeah, V plus, tensor V minus, tensor V plus. Then I do a flip. So I flip these two things, sigma, then I add V plus, tensor V plus, tensor V minus. And then I can do Z on this evaluation to go back to V plus. So this is what the field theory will assign to a Bordism, which looks like this. And I can write it just out of these building blocks.
So the flipping thing was necessary because
Because yeah, okay, we need it. One of the half circles is defined through a flipping. Okay, I'm reading it.
Yeah, yeah, right. I somehow said there are four half circles. You could have specified all of them by say, like they are always related by flipping the endpoints. So I just specified this one and this one for reasons which might become clear in a bit. And then if I only have these two things to write, evaluate a circle, I need to use one flip. Yeah.
Also, I presume, well, I don't know, QFTs in a line, I think, are quantum mechanics or something.
Yeah.
Some topological quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
Is there any intuition I could use from that to also give meaning to these drawings?
Yes. I think so. I mean, right, first of all, there's a thing which is called topological quantum mechanics, which is slightly different. But here, what you should think of this, right, what does it mean to be topological? It's really that the Hamiltonian is zero in this case, right?
Okay.
So you have some vector space, Hilbert space V, and then you would, to an interval, you would assign the time evolution. But the time evolution, the Hamiltonian is zero, so the time evolution doesn't do anything, so it's the identity. So you already see that to this you would want to assign the identity. But then there are also these slightly weirder things which come from reversing the direction of time, which is like something like taking the dual.
Okay, and then these compositions, these weird things were, yeah, whatever, okay.
Yeah, but this is something like computing a trace or something like that.
If you presented, say, the circle as a non-trivial knot, can the structure set detect that or not?
No, because it's symmetric monoidal.
That's related to the braided thing.
I mean, I have drawn this as a crossing, but it's really, I mean, it's not embedded in some R3 or so. So it's required to be symmetric monoidal. So in particular, I should maybe have drawn it like this. So the crossing will, there's no over or under crossing. And this is the symmetry. So there are versions of the Bordism category, which is somehow embedded in some ambient R3 here, where you would see these crossings. And then they are not symmetric monoidal, they're only braided monoidal. Again, this is, this is really as abstract manifolds, not as things embedded in R3, just so that I can draw what's going on. Okay. So, okay, let me reiterate the conclusion we should draw. It's to specify a one-dimensional field theory, I need to specify these two vector spaces and these two maps. And that's all the data. But then they need to satisfy some relations. But you cannot consider them arbitrarily. And so this is... this is last week. But in 1D, there are not that many relations we need to impose. And this is going to happen in the next exercise. So there's an exercise which is just to convince yourself, which means like proof, but only up to the level that you are happy, that all relations change between two Bordisms are induced by the following two relations. I can look at this composition, and as a Bordism, we see that this is the same as the identity. And then I can look at this composition, which we see is the identity on the negatively oriented point. And you somehow see what could happen is, if I start building things out of these things, it could happen that I stick this thing on top of that one, and I built something which looks like a line, which actually was not a line. So there's a relation that this type of composition is the identity. And I'm somehow saying this plus the symmetric monoidality and just compatibility with disjoint union, these two relations induce all the other relations. And this is somehow intuitively clear, because if something, at least I think so, if something like, if you only have one of these things, there's not much which can happen. Because then you just get a bunch of these type of things or those. And to cancel something, you somehow need to have stick them like this. Because if you have a circle, you're also good.
Sorry, but I don't understand what, I feel some orientation is weird or something, or is it supposed to be like that?
What's weird?
What am I supposed to do with these lines? These in the middle, equality? I shouldn't join them.
This is equal to that. This is one equation, and then there's a second equation.
Okay, there we go.
So, okay. Right, this is a morphism in the one-dimensional Bordism category. This is one, which is the identity. And then there's a second equation.
Right, yeah.
Sorry. There are two equations. And they are all the ones we need. And now we get the following consequence of just this exercise, which I will just denote as a lemma, or just a summary of somehow what happens, which is the category of 1D PQFTs is equivalent and to the category to give you a category, I need to give you objects and morphism to the category with. So the objects are exactly the following data. It's a pair of vector spaces. Spaces V plus and V minus. And linear maps which I call evaluation V plus tensor V minus to C. So this is the value of the field theory on this morphism. And the other thing I call a co-evaluation, which goes from C to V minus tensor V plus, and then they need to satisfy conditions. And the conditions are the following. So if I now I'm using the graphical calculus we learned about last week or 2 weeks ago. So this is a map from V plus, this is a V minus to V plus, which is exactly the value of the snake morphism. Then I want this to be the identity on V plus. And the other condition is the value on the other snake morphism. So I do the co-evaluation, the evaluation. And this is a map from V minus to V minus. And this is the value on the other snake identity, that this is the identity on V minus.
So it's like a category of functors?
Yeah, it's a category of symmetric monoidal functors, and the morphisms are the symmetric monoidal natural transformation.
Wait, which one is a category of functors?
So there's a category of one-dimensional TQFTs. A TQFT is a functor.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the morphism between them is a natural transformation.
Yeah.
And now I'm giving you, so there's this category of functors, and now I give you a different way of describing the same category. I say that this category of one-dimensional TQFTs is the same as the category where the object consists of a pair of vector spaces, V plus and V minus, in addition with two linear maps, evaluation, which goes from here to here, and co-evaluation, which goes from here to there. And then there's a condition they have to satisfy. So one object in this category is all this data. I have not told you what the morphisms are.
This is some. There are not just two objects, right? It's like in a monoidal sense, I can take several V pluses, right?
I mean, one object is all this data. So for every time, there's every, right, one object.
Yes.
To give an object in this category, I need to give you two vector spaces and these maps satisfying these relations.
Morphisms.
That's what I was wanted to say next. And I mean, this should be obvious from what we've done so far. That this is like the category of one-dimensional TFTs. And then the morphisms are not, because we didn't talk about them. Right? I mean, these two relations here just translate these relations into what they go to under the evaluation of the field theory. And I think I want to label them. Yep. So this is 2.1. And this is 2.2. We use them later. And then morphisms. So morphism consists of a pair of maps. It consists of eta plus, which goes from V plus to V plus. And eta minus, which goes from V minus to V minus. And then it needs to satisfy some compatibility condition with the evaluation and the co-evaluation.
Should be W plus A aggregate.
Yep. It should be from one object V plus V minus,
yeah, exactly,
to another object V plus prime V minus prime. And the compatibility is the following. If I look at the evaluation for the prime object, I get eta plus and eta minus, right? So this goes from V plus V minus to V plus prime, V minus prime, and then I can apply the evaluation to go to C. But I can also go directly to C by doing the evaluation. So I want these two things to be equal. And then the same for the co-evaluation. So I start with the co-evaluation. This goes to V minus V plus. I do eta minus and eta plus. And then I'm here. And I want this to be co-evaluation. Fine. It goes to V minus prime V plus prime. Okay. And this is 2.3, and this is 2. So this is a statement which will require a proof. Because I'm telling you that like one category is the same as another category. I'm somehow telling you giving a field theory is giving, in 1D is giving this data, giving a morphism of field theories is giving this data. So I mean, as I said, the objects should be clear from what we did so far. And what's not so clear are the morphisms, or I mean, what we have not really talked about. So that's for the morphisms. What we do is we fix some natural, or we look at a natural transformation from Z to Z prime. which is symmetric monoidal. This already means that I only need to know its value at a positive point. It goes from here to here, and its value at a negative point, which goes from here to here. And we, this was v plus, this was v plus prime, v minus minus prime. And then all the value at all other objects in the Bordism category is just going to be the tensor product of these things. Okay. And then well, the other thing we need is that it's natural, right? So now it's monoidal, but we need to make sure that it's also natural. So we need to ensure that diagrams of the form Z of some object, Z of some morphism, going to some other object. Now I do eta at this. I do eta here. And I want this diagram to commute. And this is Z prime. But now we know that all the M's can be built out of these generating ones we had before. So I only need this diagram to commute for the generating morphisms, right? And there are only two of those, which is this one and that one. So I need to check that this diagram commutes if I plug in these two things. This is what I called evaluation. This is what I called co-evaluation. And then you can just see if you plug the generating morphisms in, you will get this relation and that relation. So we have this, and then plug in generating morphisms. And then this shows that this is exactly the data you get for a natural transformation. Questions.
So how do you put unitary function?
What?
Unitary.
Oh, that's a longer story. Okay. Right. I mean, there's something you might naively try. You just say, okay, let's take as the target Hilbert spaces, right? This seems like a good thing. But now the problem is, as a category, Hilbert spaces is just equivalent to vector spaces. So you learn nothing. It's like, then unitary would be nothing. So you need to actually think more about what it means. And what makes Hilbert spaces better than vector spaces is that this has an involution which takes the adjoint. So you want your field theory to be compatible with this notion of taking adjoints. So you want, on the Bordism side, there's the notion of orientation reversal, and you want this to correspond to the operation which takes adjoints. Complicated story.
And why Hilbert spaces are, or whatever that equal twiddle means.
Equivalent.
Equivalent.
Why?
Why are they equivalent to vector spaces?
I mean, every vector space admits a Hilbert space. So.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I just think of Hilbert spaces somewhat, it should be somewhat smaller in a way.
I mean, it depends on what type of maps. You might want to do Hilbert spaces and unitary maps. But the problem is, these type of maps, they will never be unitary, because a unitary map is always an isomorphism. And I mean, if you want this to be a unitary map, then the like H tensor H needs to be isomorphic to C. So there are no, right? So these things, you don't want them to be unitary. You just want them to be compatible with the Hilbert space structure. We might talk about this at some point.
What I would think is, in the Hilbert space, I have an inner product structure, and my morphisms are compatible with that, so they're isometries of some sort. I don't know if they're invertible.
Yeah, okay, you can take isometries, right?
And then I would imagine there are less morphisms than there were in the vector category.
Yeah.
I removed a few.
But you also don't want this and this to be an isometry.
So it's a problem of compatibility with the TQFT part? The fact that...
But also generally, if you do Hilbert spaces, you usually don't restrict to isometries. Right? There are a lot of things you do with Hilbert spaces where you not, right, there are things you do which are not isometries, right? You care about, like, I don't know, operators which are not unitary or things like that. So, and then if you take Hilbert spaces and all maps between them, then this is the same as taking vector spaces.
Okay.
I mean, just the same as. I should also say, right, this is not going to be the, where is this? Okay, the statement disappeared. I mean, this is not going to be the, somehow the complete answer of what it is. It's like one step on the way of finding what they are. So we take this data and we will now simplify it more. But generally, if you have a type of structure, it's sometimes good to do some of just giving it a name and abstracting it. And that's what we will do. We will now just give a name to a structure like this. And we can do this in any category. That's what will happen. And so far, we worked with a symmetric monoidal category. So we could always flip inputs. The definition works more generally in a monoidal setting. But then you need to distinguish between left and right. And we will only do the right version. Because in the symmetric monoidal case, that's all we need. But in general, you need to also, you might have situations where you care about the other version. So. Version as well. Okay. The definition fix some monoidal category. And then we say a right dual. Dual to X in C is an object X dual, which also lives in C, plus together with morphisms. What I call evaluation x, which goes from x tensor x dual to the monoidal unit, and co-evaluation, which goes from the monoidal unit to x dual tensor x, satisfying 2.1 and 2.2. And you see these equations we have drawn in such a way that they make sense in any monoidal category. And then and then the next thing we define is a category duals in C, which is just, so the objects are duals. So dual is the category with objects, so they are pairs, exactly x dual, evaluation, co-evaluation, so they are just an object together with a choice of a right dual, and then morphisms. morphisms are pairs. Okay, these are actually quadruples. And the morphisms are pairs F plus from X to X prime, F minus from X dual to X, from X, yeah, X dual to X prime dual. Satisfying. Satisfying 2.3 and 2.4. And then just as a direct consequence of the definition and the work we did in proving this lemma is that if I now want to study a field theory which doesn't take values in vector spaces but in some symmetric monoidal target category, it's just always going to be the one-dimensional field theories will always be the category of duals in C. So this is just something we want to study. But something, if we understand this category, we understand what one-dimensional TQFTs are. Oh, okay.
No, sorry, what is the last claim you're making, sorry?
We defined TQFTs with values in some general target, right?
With values in some general what, sorry?
Target, not vector spaces, but just a symmetric monoidal category as a target.
Okay, we're defining it now?
No, we defined it last week.
Last week, okay.
You can ask if I just take whatever target you want here. Like, take your favorite symmetric monoidal category. You can ask what are one-dimensional field theories in there. And I tell you it's like the category of pairs of an object and its dual in C. This will always be the category of field theories in C. Right?
Okay, so you take the category C and you build a different category. Wait.
Yeah. We start with a symmetric monoidal category C. We build a new category.
Whose objects are X and its X dual
and
pairs of
exactly.
Maps.
And then morphisms are these pairs of morphisms. And this is like the category of pairs of an object and a dual in C.
Okay.
And the statement is that this category will always be the category of one-dimensional field series with values in some category, and you also know how to compute its value on any morphism, right? You just do this decomposition, and you compose the things in C.
Well, what's the value of relaxing the target category so that it's so? Well, I mean, so it's a class. Okay. Whatever, we're characterizing it in a way, so it's doable.
Yeah.
And it's fully like. Yeah, we know what it is, apparently.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, we will just start studying some pop consequences of this definition. And I mean, the first thing, when you define a new object, so I defined a right dual to X, you should ask yourself, like, how unique is it? Is there always a right dual? If there is one, how many are there? These are, like, good questions to ask. And if there is one, it's in general hard. So sometimes there is one, sometimes there isn't. A nice exercise is, for example, to figure out what objects emit duals in the category of sets. Or what objects emit duals in the category of a topological space. And then you will see there are not many. But we will, for example, give a complete description for vector spaces next week, I guess. But the nice thing is, if I have a dual, it's always unique. And this is the following proposition. So let X dual and X prime dual be a right dual to X. So this means I, in particular, this comes with an evaluation and a co-evaluation. And this comes with an evaluation and co-evaluation. So if I have this, let's say they are all in C, then there exists a unique isomorphism which I call F, which goes from X dual to X prime dual, which in addition satisfies the condition that if I look at the pair identity comma X as a map from X X dual to X comma X prime dual, so this pair, and then there's the evaluation and co-evaluation I'm not writing out, that this pair defines a map in the category of dual object, so is a morphism in duals. So what I'm saying is somehow if there are two objects which are dual to X, there's a unique isomorphism which relates these two things. So they are isomorphic, but even better, they are isomorphic via something which is unique. And this is somehow as good as uniqueness will get in category theory. So you should really think of them as being the same. Okay.
And what about existence? Is it obvious that
the dual always exists? No, the dual does not always exist.
Okay.
But if there are two duals, there exists a unique map comparing them.
Okay.
Yeah. Right, and in vector spaces, you only have a dual if your vector space is finite dimensional.
You only have a dual if your vector space is finite.
Yeah, we will prove that, as I said, next week.
Okay. Meaning the dual category.
What?
The dual of vec.
No, just take the category of vector spaces and the vector space in there. You can ask if this has a right dual object in the sense of this definition. And the answer is it only does if the vector space is finite dimensional.
Okay.
Let us do a proof. So I claim that there exists a map F which goes from X dual to X dual prime or X to the other dual I can pick. So I should tell you what the map is. So I go from X dual, then I can use the evaluation of X here. And then I do co-evaluation prime, which goes to X dual prime. So I, somehow if I would do evaluation and co-evaluation, this identity, which is somewhere, would tell me that this composition is the identity, but now I do once the prime version, once the original one, and this goes from X dual to X prime. So the one thing I claim is that this is an iso. So I should better also tell you what its inverse is. So the inverse goes from X dual prime to X dual, and it's exactly the same. You just replace primes with non-primes. So I have X dual prime. I do evaluation prime. I do co-evaluation. And I do this. Okay. And now, why is this an isomorphism? To check this, we just need to check the composition, which is given by this type of picture, where I just stick these two things on top of each other. But now you see, if I stick this picture on top of this one, I have a co-evaluation composed with an evaluation, which is not primed. So I can just take this thing and replace it with an identity. So this is the same as this type of picture, which then is again an identity. And you can check that the other composition is the identity in the same way. So we did that. Okay. Now the next thing we should check is that it's actually, if I combine it with the identity, then it's a morphism in this category of things with dual. So I need to check the compatibility with evaluation and co-evaluation of the morphism.
And why is it unique?
What?
I mean, the second was that it's a unique
app. Ah, yeah, this I will also, I can also do that first, I think. Yep. No, let's first check that it's compatible, and then we will check uniqueness. Because it's only unique if you require this extra condition that it's compatible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, otherwise I could just compose this with any automorphism. So let's first see why is it compatible. So we just check it for the co-evaluation. Right, so we have this. Then I just plug in what f is. I think this is co-evaluation prime.
Sorry, what is the compatibility we're checking right now?
If it's there on the board, that would be good. Equation 2.3 or 2.4.
Yeah.
Good.
On the right, top right, I think. Is the
Yeah, we're checking 2.4. Right, I take the co-evaluation, I compose it with f and the identity. I want to see that this is the co-evaluation prime. So far, I just insert the definition for f, which is like evaluation. Co-evaluation, I inserted it on the wrong side. No, I confused myself. Let's redo this. Okay, we have the co-evaluation.
Yeah.
And now f is evaluation prime, co-evaluation prime. No, it's evaluation, co-evaluation prime. This is how we defined f here. It's evaluation, co-evaluation.
Okay.
And now we see here, we have a co-evaluation and an evaluation. So I can take this and replace it with an identity. So I get this with a co-evaluation prime. Okay. So this is one of the compatibilities. You check the other one exactly the same way. And now, why is this unique? It's unique, so assume we have some other f prime, which satisfies this type of compatibility condition. Then what I can do is I can just take the identity here and insert a relation like this. This is the f prime. But then here, I insert this type of thing. But now I know that f, so this is, oh, no, it's, what do I want? Dual prime. So here I want co-evaluation. Yep, exactly. And now I know I have this relation that I can, if I have an f on top of a co-evaluation, I can pull it through and get a co-evaluation prime. So this is the same as co-evaluation prime, evaluation this. But this is exactly how we defined f. So as soon as I have an f prime, which does the same type of thing, I know it's equal to f. Okay. Let me just, maybe say what we will do next week. we will continue studying this category, which is like the category of pairs of duals, and see the next thing we will see it's a groupoid. So any map in there will be an isomorphism. And then furthermore, we will actually see that this has a map to some subgroupoid in C, and this map turns out to be an equivalence. So actually you can identify 1D field theories just with certain objects in your category C. And all the structure which was part of the theory is somehow it's uniquely fixed. We have already seen that having a dual is uniquely fixed because we have, right, this is what we just proved, is that if there's a dual, it's uniquely fixed. So if you know V plus, like V, you don't need to ask what V minus do I pick, fix. There's only one you can fix because it's the only one which has all this compatibility. And we will just see that this is somehow also true for the other parts of the structure. So the evaluation and co-evaluation will also be unique. So we will see it's just the 1D TFTs will just be identified with this subcategory here. And then for vector spaces, this will exactly be the groupoid of finite dimensional vector spaces and maps between them. And then from this, we get two consequences. The first one is that the state space of any theory is one-dimensional bidimensional reduction. And because this is a groupoid, meaning all maps are invertible, also every natural transformation needs to be actually invertible. Okay. So let me stop here and then continue next week by doing these things. Questions?
Is recording available in the website?
Yes, it should.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Other questions?
So I could repeat what we want to conclude by this reduction to 1D to QFTs again?
I mean, right, what I'm telling you is somehow, or what we are working towards is a complete understanding of 1D TQFTs. And then if you have any TQFT, right, if n is larger than 2, we don't really have a complete understanding of how they look. But anyway, if I fix an object in here, I can always look at this reduction on the object. So I can reduce the whole theory on this object. This will be a 1D theory. So everything I learn about the 1D theory also applies to the state space, to Z on this. So in particular, if you know that every 1D theory assigns a finite dimensional vector space to the point, you can automatically conclude that any field theory assigns a finite dimensional vector space to any manifold by doing this dimensional reduction.